Let's see, Paul, I know we're at the top of the hour. Should we go ahead and get started? I know we're also recording.
Yes, we should get started. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Yeah, I assume
Okay,
you
yes,
can
let's
hear me.
see. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome to all of the Meerkat PIs and their personnel, the extended team for the research center. Today we have an opportunity to give an overview of the DECODE project and many of the I guess the leadership team for our project is online and we'll be sharing the presentation. I'm going to start off by kicking off with a few introductory slides, and then I think each of our thrust leads will take over for me for sharing their slides. So let me find the link for sharing. Okay, are you all seeing this in presentation mode?
Yep.
All right, very good. So, for this overview, I'm Antonino, and I will give kind of an introduction to the democratization of co-design, and then to present our thrust one, David Brooks from Harvard will be giving that, and for thrust two. I know John Liddell is on. I guess I wasn't sure if I saw Andreas Olofsson, but one or both of them can present thrust two. Luca Carloni will from Colombia will present thrust three. And as shown in this graphic, thrust one is co-design of energy efficient system in a package. Technology. Thrust two is open source co-design tools. Thrust three is prototyping and chiplet integration. Let me start off by just describing really the core of our objective for DECODE. I won't read all the text here for you, but basically, our approach is to democratize co-design through the realization that design of R&D prototype hardware is analogous to and can apply lessons from the development of R&D prototype software. We leverage open source hardware design, generation, and analysis tools that can be used to target prototype and low volume fabrication versus production. And this is an important concept for us to be aware of. We try to delay the use of commercial EDA tools because they are expensive, and that introduces barriers for vendor proprietary design data, and delay that until the conceptual designs, the research that we pursue shows promise that hardware design approaches are ready for non-recurring engineering investments, and that's where costs really significantly ramp up. We try to leverage CHIPS Act investments that are really establishing an infrastructure for hardware prototyping and things like an open chiplet ecosystem that focus on helps us focus on domain specialized hardware design and generation while reusing chiplet designs for conventional general purpose processors, memory interfaces, network interfaces, etc. We introduced this concept. It's actually an old concept from the product world of MVP, minimum viable product. And the idea here is to use MVP test hardware to provide concrete measures of performance improvement, power and energy utilization, where we're exercising our concepts with real application workloads. In an MVP, a lot of the focus is on core functionality, where we're targeting novel or innovative architecture designs. And for us, that really is based on heterogeneous computing concepts. The most important feedback for us comes from early adopters, and the most critical early adopters for us are software developers for algorithms, applications, and the software stack, compilers and runtimes. And I guess, again, a lesson from the software world is that we're trying to support agile technology development and really to support a path to having rapid design cycles to help explore a design space to help guide the development of future advanced computing concepts, and specifically for decode, energy efficient computing concepts. Very quickly, this is a summary of the entire team. You'll be hearing from our leadership team that includes representation from most of these institutions, with the exception of Washington State University, Rice University, and University of Minnesota. But this table shows all the contributions and that the institutions provide to our team. Along, you have a question? If you can mute yourself, that'd be great. Do you have a question? All right, let me move on. Let's see. Where am I? Oh, here we go. So our approach really is focused on the idea that we could target heterogeneous computing. This arises naturally when you talk about energy efficient accelerators combined with general purpose processors. But we actually have some history at PNNL in internal investments, LDRD investments, in something called the Data Model Convergence Initiative, where we think about converged workloads being traditional scientific computing, other types of AI methods and applications, as well as data analytics applications. And the target then for us is either can span scales from the large scale high performance computing systems to edge computing with integrated sensors. Skipping down here. A lot of our innovation in decode is focused on some concepts for custom analog accelerator designs that are very energy efficient. But the examples that we use are really exemplars that we hope should be generalizable to a range of other accelerator types. And really, many of the candidates that are being pursued within Meerkat and other projects are opportunities that we think could be relevant for us. Let's see. And maybe with that, I will pass the microphone over to Antonino.
Thank you very much, Jim. So I'll briefly go detailing a little bit the objectives of the Tri-Trust, and then obviously you will hear from the leadership team the details. But basically, our Tri-Trust, as Jim has introduced, right, are looking at the chiplet ecosystem on one side, including the novel technologies and analog type of accelerators. And the second class will be about the design automation tools, and then we'll bring close the loop basically with the prototyping. So for the first one, really the focus is on the co-design process for this heterogeneous system in a package that should include the digital conventional accelerators, the processors, and basically create this catalog of open chiplets, but also prepare like the system and bring the co-design to the level of can we implement and leverage new type of accelerators that are higher energy efficient. And in particular with our exemplar for people that are three-dimensional computing that can be implemented both in digital or in near memory analog versions, and the resistively coupled dynamical system machine, which is of the electricalyzing machine that able to deal with things that are not anymore just zero and one. The three-dimensional computing will be led by Tatiana Rosing in UC San Diego, and the RDSM work instead by Tom Zhang from RISE. And yeah, like the there is a part obviously on the work because we as you see in the tools we have available a number of generators together with the co-design tools, so we want to be able to assign them, but we want also able to create a low cost agile system in the package that can be used and be available also to the market teams so that we can really, as Jim highlighted, enable this flow from the concept to the prototype. And I think we can move to the second trust. Again, so was highlighting, we have available, and you see a number of tools already, a number of capabilities of open source tools that come from our various partners. The focus of Decode will be integrating these tools to create a much larger ecosystem of co-design tools that will enable really us to bring the concept of a system in a package evaluated and generated and then taped out, right? Really, we want to provide the substrate and also including compilers, right, to be able to quickly go from the idea, assemble the system, and enable the design of the system in a package. The last trust is bringing everything together with the prototyping and chiplet integration. Again, from the trust builds, but the team has a lot of experience in prototyping and tape outs. So we bring internal prototyping capabilities, including FPGA platforms that are already available, and to kind of integrate the custom accelerator and do the test. We'll enable that to emulate our system in a package, but also like with the EDA tools, we'll enable integration with the capabilities, the standard capabilities. Now, we need to see what happens with the National Semiconductor Center, but one of the focus will be trying to establish connection with NSTC and foundries so that we can enable this digital group. And I think that the last slide is the least of our background repositories. Jim, please, I think it's switching slowly, but it's a long list, right? So I understand. So these are already available, right? So we start from strong foundation. These are all the tools that you can go already use and leverage, and hopefully you are already doing that. But hopefully with the Decode, we'll bring this to plus plus version, right, that will enable a co-design tool chain available for the fast prototyping cycle. And I think this was the last slide, Jim, right?
I will stop sharing and then we can pass the feed over to David Brooks. David, take it away. Great.
Are you able to see my slide? Okay.
Yes.
Great. Let's see. Here we go. Okay. So yes, I'm happy to present Thrust One on behalf of Deanna Rosing, myself, and the Thrust One co-leads for the project. If you think about the overarching motivation for a lot of what we're looking at these days, it's this notion of scale of AI compute and the cost growing at an enormous rate. And this is just a graph from Epic AI. If you are interested in looking at trends, they have a lot of really interesting data on the website. This is showing the training compute needed for these frontier LLMs that are available today. And you can see the growth rate has gone up by between 4 and 5x per year over the last decade or so. We have, of course, have seen increases in the flops and the memory bandwidth to go with that, but not nearly at the same rate. And this is really increasing the training costs at a pretty large hefty rate of 3.5x per year. So the training compute requirements are going up. The ability to provide the flops and the computation is not scaling at the same rate. So we're in this deficit that is part of the reason we're seeing such huge investments in AI, because people still want to proceed, but the costs are going up. And as Jim mentioned, we want to think about lower cost ways of driving computing, and we believe chiplets are one of those solutions that, particularly for DOE applications, could allow drastically improved performance without this enormous cost. In Thrust One, we're thinking about this in the context of the co-design of energy-efficient chiplets for these system and packages. And the goal is to explore a mix of different types and styles of accelerators for AI applications. So the goal really is to come up with these mix of heterogeneous chiplets that combine computing paradigms, so some of them conventional and some of them new, and addressing specific aspects of AI that have been less well explored. So, for example, Tiana's work on hyperdimensional computing, the work that we have in the next task on Ising machines and dynamical systems are really new approaches to addressing machine learning. And likely what we will see in the future is mixtures of these approaches using mixtures of different technologies, some digital, some analog, in these system and packages. And that's the goal. The thrust is to also understand how to bring those different diverse types of chiplets together. So this integration of different IP styles. I'll give you a flavor of how this work and why analog and HD computing are interesting. So just we start from the observation that the human brain doesn't process information in simple low-dimensional forms like pixel grids or individual signals. Instead, it converts dense sensory inputs, things like the images that come through our eyes, into high-dimensional sparse representation across neurons. And this mapping step is basically how we think human perception and cognition works. So if you look at the picture on the left, that's showing light hitting a retina, the signal passing through these visual areas, the brain representing that information as a distributed pattern, basically a high-dimensional vector. And there's studies from about a decade ago that showed that this sparse high-dimensional encoding makes the brain's computation both efficient, robust, and flexible. HD computing takes that principle and applies it to machine learning. It encodes data in what are called hypervectors. These vectors have thousands of dimensions, and then uses simple algebraic operations to manipulate them. And that's really the key. These operations are fully parameterizable. They're very simple and makes them much more energy efficient and resilient to noise. HD computing has seen a lot of research interest over the past decade, and people have shown that it can be used for online learning, symbolic reasoning, explainability, and so forth. Big challenges for today's AI. On the right, you can see the domains that this has been applied to: image classification, LiDAR segmentation, genomics, mass spectrometry, even recommendation systems. And so the point is that with this mathematical framework, the hyperdimensional representation, we can handle data that spans very different kinds of representations, from images to molecules to graphs. So Tiana's research group is one of the leaders in this area. She's been working on this for quite a while. And If you look at some of the progression, the original work in this area, which was looking at conventional image recognition applications using purely HD approaches, what you found is that the results work really well for small data sets like MNIST, but didn't do so well when you looked at the larger ones like CIFAR and ImageNet. And more recently, the algorithm investment in this area has shown that HD combined with CNN layers can get the best of both worlds, meaning the accuracy of conventional image classification using CNNs, but with the efficiency of hyperdimensional computing. And this hybrid architecture style works, you can see the picture on the right, works by pruning many of the CNN layers and inserting an HD encoding step that converts the extracted features into high-dimensional binary hypervectors. And then these hypervectors are classified using the algebraic operation. So instead of using these compute-heavy layers, it's using much simpler algebraic operations for those final steps. And you can see the results in the table showing that we can achieve almost the same performance using the HD and N approach, but with basically the same accuracy as traditional CNNs. Tiana's group has also explored implementing these techniques in test chips. So she has three test chips that she's worked on in collaboration with TSMC. Some of these are digital and some of these are analog. And I think that's one of the interesting approaches to this is that there are opportunities to leverage things like resistive RAMs and do this analog style computing using hyperdimensional computing. And again, this is why this is a promising approach because with our chiplet style architecture, we can imagine including an HDC chiplet next to a CNN chiplet, next to some other kind of chiplet, and combine the best of both worlds in terms of the neural network style or machine learning style. So now I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about how we imagine integrating that existing IP. And most of this work is building on the efforts from Andrea Olsson's company called Zero ASIC, which has been one of the leaders in trying to establish standards for chiplet ecosystems, particularly for these style of prototypes like the one that I just showed, where there's a little bit different from the NVIDIA style, where you have these massive chiplets that are taking up full reticle. These are looking at smaller chiplets and how to put them together. So the goal that Andreas's team has is to build a full stack chiplet standard with the protocol layer, basically the way that the memory is addressed using what's called universal memory interface. Basically make everything addressable. That's the goal, is to be able to fully address all the different parts of the chiplets using this universal memory interface. And inspired by sort of the abstraction standards that have been built up over time in other areas of computer science, they've defined these different layers of the stack from the protocol down to the electrical layer. They've also been looking at trying to come up with standardized footprints that allow you to imagine plugging into something like a breadboard, except this would be plugging in chiplets with very fine pitch for high connectivity, rotational symmetry, so it doesn't matter how you put your chiplet there, be able to use this for both analog with various power domains, passing through to other systems and whatnot. And then also defining some of the electrical and standards or how you communicate between the chiplets. Oops. Let me see. I messed up my screen. Yeah, here's the next slide. Okay, so standardized discrete chiplets. So the goal, again, building on what Zero ASIC has been pushing, is to come up with this Lego brick standard, except for chiplets, where we define that standard, and then just like Lego bricks have remained the same for so many years, can we do that for discretized chiplets so that I could come up with a grid, come up with standard size chiplets, and then as long as you build this chiplet with this size, you'll be able to plug it in to a package. This is how I imagine low cost prototyping moving in the future, and also perhaps low volume but high important computing strategies where you could imagine prototyping with thousands or tens of thousands of chiplets instead of needing to have millions that you would have to build a custom ASIC. And being able to do this across different technology nodes with different chiplet spacings and pitch month ratios, and ideally building this and thinking about all the constraints early so that we have a long-lasting legacy of the ability to carry forward. Zero ASIC has built several composable chiplet prototypes already. This is just a mix of designs from a CPU, an FPGA to a memory. And they show that using these standard approaches, they can drastically reduce the amount of design time, amount of designers needed to be able to design these. Very impressive results in some of these diverse, very diverse sets of applications. So with that, I will wrap things up and happy to take any questions.
Thank you, David. I think we might hold questions for the end. So, and actually, now we'll hear next from I'm not sure if it's Andreas or John Liddell, who are co-leading Thrust 2.
I think we're going to share the burden here.
Okay. Okay. Very good.
I'll bring up the slides, and then John's going to speak on the first three tasks, and I'll speak about the last three. So let me share my screen here.
And David, thank you for giving a very good overview this closing session of zero ASICs capabilities. So fantastic.
All right, here we go. Okay, you see that okay?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So you know, David spoke about actualizing, real circuits. Thrust 2 is more about the tooling to create the circuits, and creating open source co-design tools to lift all boats or lift all ships. So there's six different tasks in this area, and ranging from efficient algorithms for analog computing, compilers frameworks, architectural simulations, and then heterogeneous SIP, thermal analysis, co-design, and then IP generators. So it's sort of a stack from like a full stack software, algorithms to bits is the way I would look at it. Represented by participants from PNNL, from Harvard, from TCL, Wisconsin, Washington State, Minnesota, and Zero ASIC. So with that, I'm going to hand over to John to speak about 2.1 to 2.3.
All right, perfect. So the first task in this is led by PNNL, and this is where everything sort of starts. One of the issues that we've had previously is going from traditional sort of instruction set-based digital designs into more chiplet ecosystems, system in package, and analog designs, is there's really a lack of focus on the algorithm infrastructure necessary to port applications and actually get real kernels and real workloads executing efficiently to realize all of the energy efficiency and programmatic efficiency of the various different devices. So this is very analogous to sort of the quantum world where they had to sort of crawl out of the primordial ooze and start developing new programming models, new compiler techniques, and new algorithms sufficient to actually utilize real quantum systems. So as we move into the space of brain-inspired HDCs, there's a lot of interesting proposals with respect to porting things like neural networks, sparse linear algebraic solvers, and various different high-dimensional random vector algorithms onto these analog computing platforms. And this thrust area is specifically focused on developing those algorithmic constructs in a way that we can move from a very high-level conceptual design down to more of a co-design ecosystem where we start cross-collaborating with the compiler subtask, which is thrust
Hello, how you
2,
doing?
as well as
Good.
collaborating with some of the other hardware implementation thrusts that we can begin mapping sort of traditional instruction set concepts down to more analog style computing devices. So this is going to be really key and very influential across all the different domains of the DECODE project. Okay, on to the next slide, Andreas. So this is where things start to move more into traditional computer science. So PNNL is again leading the compiler and accelerator compiler framework and accelerator generators. I hate saying those two words together. So with the advent of accelerated computer architectures, we've done a fairly good job of putting together very coarse-grained programming models like CUDA and SICL and OpenCL, and even some of the OpenMP and OpenACC target offload specifications to take traditional sort of iterative approaches to algorithmic design and begin doing parallel computing with host and target offload. That's been fairly simplistic. Accelerators traditionally live on the other end of a relatively inefficient bus or inefficient interconnect. And now with the system in packages, as we start to standardize the interfaces across these various different heterogeneous devices that may or may not live inside even reasonably similar clock domains or architectural models, we need to start raising the level of abstraction in the compiler frameworks such that we have any chance of all and actually taking traditional parallel applications and begin executing them with some degree of efficiency. So this particular thrust area is going to really focus on using LLVM and MLIR to start building dialects around performing explicitly heterogeneous computing across computing domains on a system and package. So this is going to quite literally reutilize a lot of the existing dialects that are being used for parallel computing in the AI and ML space, as well as we can hoist some of the interesting efforts being done in the quantum space for MLIR, as well as looking at things like some of the hardware generators that are built around MLIR to literally start doing co-design at the system and package level, sort of taking the pandas and bamboo work previously done at PNNL and start bringing that ecosystem into the sort of top level application level compilation and optimization frameworks. So this is going to be a very interesting effort that could not only bear fruit in the system and package world, but also bear fruit in the future, sort of digital centric, large scale monolithic chiplets ecosystem as well. Okay, on to the next slide, Andreas. So the Thrust 2.3, which is a co-effort between TCL and David Brooks's group at Harvard, is the architectural simulation of heterogeneous SIPs. So architectural simulators is something that is both near and dear to my heart and something that everyone loves to hate. Historically, architectural simulators are both fantastic and allow you to accelerate co-design workflows and are also demonized in the sense that if the architectural simulator is not well-formed and well-written, then it doesn't accurately represent the particular device you're attempting to simulate. So what we seek to do with this is actually combine two efforts that have sort of started holistically at Harvard and TCL. The first of which is what's called Harvard Cascade, which is a high-level design exploration infrastructure that allows users to explore application domains, whether they're dense or sparse, or whether you're targeting a specific numerical representation, and combine that with some kernel partitioning logic that allows you to then, using topological concerns and energy and device scaling concerns, and start looking at the design space exploration of, okay, here's an application, here's what the kernels are specifically going to do. what is the prescriptive level of chiplet or chiplet devices that best fit this particular application? I have this much energy, this much device area. What's the correct mixture of where these things go? The flip side of that is the TCL SST infrastructure, which is entirely based upon Sandia's structural simulation toolkit, is a large-scale parallel discrete event simulator really designed to take applications or application traces and then do very fine-grained analysis of how those interact with specific architectural components. So we have a very large catalog of existing components we've simulated, things like RISC-V cores, network on chips, system in package devices that we're currently working on, memory devices. Into that list, we're going to start adding analog computing devices. And the interesting thing about the extensions that we've made to SST is we actually have a series of SST components that allow you to directly replace an existing functional simulation component with an RTL component as well. So basically, we've wrapped up your Verilog or system Verilog RTL in some C++ library magic. And then we allow you to co-simulate the sort of multimodal simulation framework. So what we seek to do with this particular thrust area is combine these high-level design space exploration concepts from Cascade with these very low-level mechanisms in TCL's SST infrastructure, and then do backward validation using a massive amount of telemetry that comes out of SST with, okay, here's your design space exploration, and here's what the high-level tools are sort of prescribing in terms of SIP architecture. What does this actually do at a more functional level with very high fidelity functional simulation or even RTL simulation? So you'll be able to sort of rinse and repeat a large number of designs back and forth through simulation, and get a very, very high degree of confidence in terms of what you seek to actually construct in real silicon. And I think I can pass it off to Andreas for Thrust 2.4.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So thrust 2.4 to 2.6, I think can be best described as filling out the picture and tying the simulation to the bits and the atoms. As was discussed, right? If you can have the best architectural simulator in the world, if it's uncoupled from physics, it's still open loop, right? You need a cost function that is grounded. And that is incredibly important and something that's been missing from architectural simulations in the past, sometimes, right? Not always, but sometimes. And so, and of course, one of the problems is that you'd like to run everything at the atomic level, but you can't afford to. And so you have to make choices. Do you have these knobs, accuracy versus performance, that are, those are conflicting. So in 2.4, one of the ideas here is that, for example, for thermal modeling, is that you're going to try to trade off and be able to leverage the full spectrum of accurate models like FEM models to analytical models that run very fast. And then, being able to do trade-offs that span from days to milliseconds, right? From many, many degrees of 5 to 10 degrees, let's say, to sub-1 degree accuracy. I can tell you that this is something that we've run into in the past, where especially early in the design process, we don't have all the information to really run the ANSYS COMSOL type physics FEM solvers or open source packages. But we'd like to have ballpark of what the system's like, and that's been a real gap. And so it's great that the team is working on this area. Second, which is kind of rhymes with thrust 2.2 in a way, is this idea of chiplet packaging and co-design optimization. And so as you're defining your chiplets, you're defining the structure and your accelerators, with heterogeneous integration and system and package, you actually have a new design space that has not been fully flushed out before. There's been a lot of talk about co-design for SoCs, where you might have IP blocks and the interfaces are completely fluid, and you do partitioning of logic into blocks. But once you start having discrete devices that may be hard-coded, and you might be mixing discrete devices with new designs, new co-processors, you do have a pretty interesting search space. And especially when you start bringing economics into the picture. So, you're not talking about not just size, weight, and power and performance, but possibly also, how many dies are you going to get out of the wafer? Which technology node are you going to be working on? Are you going to be working at 0.18 micron or at 3 nanometer? Where do you put your I/O? Where do you put your compute? Where do you put your memory? Do you want to do 2D, 3D, organic substrate? It's such a squishy search space, and it's something that most of us as architects we resort to spreadsheets still today, and so that's a huge gap in the architect's toolbox that I think this team can address. And then the last one is really down to the metal, and this is a bit of a repeat because David already showed this, so ignore the picture. I'll just talk about what we're actually doing in this task. So we're creating a full stack open source chiplet interface generator that's portable. It's going to be digital only, so ported to any node. It's going to be open source, and so if you look at and support the full stack standard that David mentioned that we're working on. So if you look at the chiplet interface space today, it is a place of the folks with the money, the rich, the big data center players. There's very few open implementations. There was one sort of open AIB that was funded by the CHIPS program at DARPA, but since then everything has pretty much been closed source, and most of it's been targeted data center rates, so very, very high frequency with analog PHYs. Which are very expensive to port, or complicated to port, and so it's a huge barrier to access. So if you want to create a low barrier, democratized chiplet-based design system, we need the artifacts, we need the IP for these interfaces. So this task is all about creating a generator, an RTL generator that supports the standard that was discussed in Thrust One. If you look at especially the right part. The electrical side, the protocol and footprints, those are pretty easy to define. It's just a spec, basically, and certainly protocols are very RTL friendly. But when it comes to the electrical interface, you have to make some very careful choices, and also have an ability to decouple things like clocking, synchronization, ESD, and so forth from the technology node in a very light matter or zero cost matter. So that's going to be the bulk of the effort here. But the outcome is delivering an open source full stack piece of IP to the community. So I think that's our thrust two. So I'll hand it off to Luca or Andrew for thrust three.
It's Luca for thrust three.
Okay.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, and let's see if I can share properly. Does it work?
Yep.
Unless maybe I'll take the video out so to avoid. So I think we are running a few minutes late, so I'll try to see if we can recover some time for Q&A. Task three is about prototyping and integration of this system in a package solution that we are pursuing. It consists of two tasks. The first one, called internal prototyping, is led by myself and Guyon at Harvard, and tackles the challenge on how we enable in-house agile design, rapid prototyping, and early software development of this advanced chiplet-based system in a package, with an emphasis on DOE applications. And the approach that we will pursue is to develop scalable open source platforms, which really are meant to make it possible to have a distributed collaborative engineering of these components, which are highly heterogeneous, as you've seen from the previous two presentations. And we are going to do that by leveraging quite a bit of experience that we had accumulated both Columbia and Harvard over the years, experience in design and developing heterogeneous system on a chip, so a monolithic system on a chip. So one of the challenges in terms of the research that we are going to do in this task is to extend this experience to chiplet-based system in a package. And similarly, we have over 10 years of experience in developing an open source hardware platform for a system on chip that has been silicon proven, as I'll show you in a minute. And again, we want to extend that to a chiplet-based system. And Jim mentioned about, Jim and Antonino mentioned about whether, which is still unclear, which chips we will be able to develop as demonstration in this. As part of this project, but we certainly aim to have quite a bit of prototyping, early prototyping using FPGAs technology, something for which we have, again, extensive experience. So experience starts with on the side of Harvard with a variety of chips that Harvard has designed and fabricated and successfully tested over the years. And you'll see them here, and I'm going to focus on one of them, maybe a couple of them, but particularly one of them, which are these Epochs chip that you see at the bottom, Epoch 0 and Epoch 1, as they were not designed just by Harvard, but they were designed by the Harvard and Columbia together, as well as IBM. In particular, I'm going to tell you as a demonstration of our approach, this Epoch 1 system on chip, and which has been really the ultimate deliverable of a 5 years plus project supported by DARPA, the domain-specific system on chip project led by IBM Research and had Columbia and Harvard and UIUC as key partners. And in fact, for the design of this chip, the PhD students at Columbia and Harvard really took the lead. This is a fairly complex chip to be designed in academia, 12-nanometer technology, 64 millimeter square. It has a fairly sophisticated frequency and voltage management, quite a bit of SRAM memory, and is highly heterogeneous. And we already heard from Jim and others the importance of heterogeneous computing. It has a tile-based architecture. It contains 23 different accelerators, which are very important for energy-efficient computing, of 14 different types. And some of them are composed in a cluster, which is the one with the red border there, which has a fairly quite novel, actually, distributed hardware power management scheme developed at IBM and for the first time tested on silicon. And this chip, all the tiles are connected by a network on chip. In fact, a multiple network on chip, six planes of 2D mesh, delivering 74 terabit per second. And this whole chip was designed by a fairly small team of mostly PhD students, led by PhD students, a couple of industry researchers, in a period of about 3 months using our approach, in particular the ESP open source platform for agile SoC design. This was the ultimate chip for this project. Before that, we had the so-called pipe cleaner, which was this Epoch Zero, which was a smaller version. You can see here the impact of our tile-based approach. Again, these are monolithic chips, not chiplets, just to be clear. And as you can go from Epoch Zero to Epoch One, you can see even at a quick glance that Epoch One is much more complex in terms along many different metrics, number of accelerators, numbers of tiles, power domains, and so forth. And in something that is a demonstration of the scalability of our approach to design these integrated circuits, is that essentially the same team of about 8 people, in fact, a junior member replaced a more senior member, design a much more complex chip in essentially the same amount of time, about 3 months. How that was possible? With various things, but in particular, when it comes to the design of the components and the RTL, by doing a lot of reuse of open source hardware intellectual property blocks. In fact, the whole chip is based on hardware, which is open source, and not all the hardware was designed by the members of the team. In fact, in particular, the four RISC-V processors, which are capable of booting Linux SMP, were designed from come from an open source project from ETH Zurich. The four NVIDIA deep learning accelerator come from NVIDIA Research. But the other components, for the most part, were designed by the team, although fairly independently. So Harvard contributed with four accelerators, IBM contributed with one accelerator and the power management scheme, and Columbia really contributed the accelerator, but and the overall glue, if you will, the memory hierarchy in the network on chip and the approach to bring things together. So this was built on top of this open source platform, ESP, which is this 12-year project that I've been leading at Columbia. And this is a snapshot of the website that I invite you to visit if you are interested. And one, there are various things that can be said about ESP, but the things that I think is most important in this context is how ESP was designed to begin with the idea of doing of promoting collaborative engineering and reuse of design. In fact, even that the components that are developed using ESP design flows, and there are a variety of design flows, are meant to be designed in a way that are highly reusable. And when I say a variety of design flow is part of the philosophy of ESP that we don't use a particular language or we don't dictate one language on one CAD tool, and we try to integrate a variety of design flow starting from different languages, whether we start RTL or C++ System C with high-level synthesis to develop accelerator, for instance, for AI application. So we even have domain-specific design flow leveraging other open source projects like HLS4ML. And then all these things can be brought together to the library, and through a fairly just push-button approach, we can arrive to FPGA prototyping. And we could do a chip like that. Maybe it wasn't exactly push-button, but in terms of design productivity, I think it was fairly impressive what we were able to achieve. So now, as we look at how we want to do things in the code, one of key components is to take this lesson and all this experience, and if you will, chipletize this approach. And we're going to do it in collaboration with Harvard, that I've already started working on a system quite scalable and modular for developing chiplets components. So we're going to bring the two things together in a platform that really is meant to not only allow to do demonstration of design with all the various components developed in the other two thrusts of the code, but also bring together some of the open source tools that you have heard more at the architectural and software level. And this particular task that we have is meant to allow in integration of these and going towards the physical design. For the physical design, there will be the second task, 3.2, led by Andrew Kang and Kevin Cao from UC San Diego and University of Minnesota, respectively. And I'm giving the presentation on their behalf. So the overarching challenge here is, again, leverage the development of an energy-efficient, domain-specialized design, particularly for DOE scientific application. And while doing this in the context of the code, at the same time, making sure that we can also leverage a lot of interaction that many of us, and particularly the leaders of this task, have with other programs, ecosystem, and standard. And here again, we have quite a bit of experience that we can leverage in chiplet design and tape out, in the development of EDA tool and infrastructure, particularly from RTL design all the way to tape out, and in collaboration with and in leading effectively many tasks, particularly in coming with standards in EDA that particularly Andrew Kang has. So Minnesota brings capability in terms of a chiplet prototyping, and these are examples of ongoing projects. San Diego brings a really remarkable leadership in developing the open road infrastructure, which is meant to produce a completely open source CAD flow for design advanced integrated circuits. To be clear, the integrated circuit that I showed before, EpoX1, was designed in part with open source tool, but when it comes to RTL to GDS2, meaning to physical synthesis and physical design, it leveraged commercial tools. So one of the challenges that we plan to tackle in the code is to bring together what you have seen with ESP and what OpenRoad does to really enable fully open source design of the chiplets, meaning the monolithic chips, as well as the collaboration also with the other trust, the chiplet-based system in a package. And in doing that, there is ongoing work and collaboration with UCLA in terms of system pathfinding for chiplets, and quite a bit of leverage of other projects led particularly by the two co-PI that lead this trust from these two NSF chip design hub and this NSF POSE phase two project, which is meant to support further development of the Open Road open source ecosystem. So it's really this about bringing everybody together. And in fact, I would say is a very proper lead for the Q&A because what we are planning to achieve today is to show what we plan to do and see if we can foster collaboration with all of you. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Luca. All right, well, I know that was a whirlwind, but maybe we have a little bit of time here for questions from any of the audience. Maybe I'll just add Luca's comments about a lot of these external collaborations. I recognize that there are linkages across Meerkat with several of the other projects that also have engagement with NSF, with maybe DoD, some of those microelectronics hubs. So there's many areas where we can, I think, join forces and speak with a common voice and within the Meerkat Research Center for the need and use of these hardware prototyping capabilities.
Yeah, thanks so much. I know Valerie's got her hand up, so I'll try to keep this one quick. First of all, thanks for a great overview. It's very exciting and great to see how the three thrusts are so well connected with each other in such a logical way. I guess one question I had, just sort of maybe of taking a step back, democratization of code design in this context obviously is very important, and a lot of the innovations that are happening sort of in the hyperscale regime are not democratized at all. But of course, a lot of the really major energy challenges societally are at the data center level. So, to what extent are the tools that are going to be developed by Decode likely to be adopted by the bigger players in this field, in the data-rich AI computing field, and particularly, companies like just recently, in the last couple of weeks, the announcement of this alliance between AMD and OpenAI, and they're actually quoting the compute in terms of the number of gigawatts that they're going to be supplying to OpenAI. So it's really the energy consumption is the new currency. It's not really necessarily the computing power. So with that in mind, how transferable or how much influence do you think these tools will have on the broader ecosystem?
Yeah, I can share my thoughts, but I'll also invite my leadership team to also add their feedback. For me, Paul, I don't view that our open source tools will ever be, like a replacement for commercial tools. That when it comes to productization, a lot of the infrastructure and the expense for using commercial tools will still remain. But I think there's an important opportunity, especially as we enter this post-Moore's Law era, where architectural innovations are going to prevail over, are going to have much, much greater potential for impact than innovations based on improvements in process technology. And I come from the DOE Exascale Computing Project world, where PathForward and StarForward investments were not meant to lead to the development of new first of a kind product designs. They were meant to actually provide a platform for hardware software co-design between the national lab software developers, algorithm developers, and the industry developers that were pursuing a calm of maybe they're analogous to MVPs again, not products, but actually working prototypes to help develop a co-design, help provide a foundation for a co-design collaboration. So our hope is that what we can do is provide existence proofs for advanced architecture concepts that would be worthy of proceeding to NRE investments. At that stage, I can't speak for DOE, but I think the natural step, as was done in the Exascale Computing project, you would actually look to competitive procurements for non-recurring engineering investments and follow-on platform procurements. That's for large scale, and that's an important step. For edge computing and many of the DOE application drivers that Meerkat's targeting, we're going to have to think about how low volume production is actually going to be a viable outcome of our research center, where there you'll never attract a commercial market to produce the kinds of microelectronics, edge computing devices that we need to deploy in our experimental user facilities, because there's not enough production volume that would be interesting to NVIDIA and AMD, et cetera. So before we move on to the other hands for questions, the leadership team, do you have any additional comments to add for Paul's question? Okay, let's Luca, go ahead.
No, no, I said I think you capture the thought. So I think we can ask it
Very good, very good.
To the next questions.
Okay, Valerie, I think you were next, and then Maya.
Okay, so thanks, Jim, and thanks, Luca, Antonia, David. So it was a really great presentation and really nice to know a lot more about Decode. My question has to do with the higher level. So I found it very interesting too that you were looking at the compiler level as well, which I think is great and so much needed and often overlooked. So I guess one question that comes up is that around programming models. And if you can comment on what you're looking at with respect to programming models. Are you taking into account different programming models? Are you looking at having a meta programming model to interoperate with different programming models? Just was wondering about your thoughts around the programming models with different applications.
Sure. And we've done a lot of background work on compiler frameworks and programming models, runtime systems. Maybe I'll actually let Antonino take this question because he's been very engaged in compiler frameworks for over a decade. So, Antonino?
Sure. So, long story short, we obviously are going to leverage something that is task-based and is very amenable on what we can do right now with frameworks that are based on MLIR. One of the opportunities that we have with MLIR is that we already have actually infrastructure that was listed in open source tools like Comet that was developed, started by Gottfried Kessler at PNL and is continuing being developed by other team members. The thing that we are using there is leveraging domain-specific languages because for scientific computing, that's potentially the way to go. And as we explore opportunities, especially for the new type of accelerators, as you have seen in the presentation, the ideas that we have is leveraging potentially specific DSS and specific libraries, right? And obviously, MLIR will enable us to do this mapping. So there's definitely a lot of opportunities there. There's a
All
lot
right.
of discussion that we can have, and
Okay.
And Valerie, you can have a longer, deeper follow-up conversation
Yeah.
with the team on this. Okay.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you, but enjoy the presentation.
Very good. Maya.
So I have a question that probably has a lot of different answers, but I know time is short. But it seems as if when you're doing a chiplet and chip design, that the majority of the time is spent in verification. And I wondered how you were addressing that, or for the MVP concept, that isn't as important as getting the ideas out there.
Part of our approach, I think, is to try and sideline a lot of the verification tasks through rapidly and inexpensively creating test hardware, so that our verification of chiplet packaging and chiplet integration comes from the use of testing. But maybe this is something Andreas could talk about, how the definition of our chiplet interfaces will also help address the verification challenge.
Hi, Maya. I think that there's a couple of things that we're doing. One is the open source aspect of some of the IP that we're developing. And so, you certainly there's less verification when you don't have to write code. So when you download, TensorFlow, PyTorch, right? Somebody else has done the verification. So yes, you do have to worry about how you compose those library functions and create the upper level logic, but at least somebody has unit tested and fuzzed and verified the lower level stuff, right? So that's a net gain. And in hardware, we generally don't do that. We do reuse some IP out there, but for the most part, we write a lot of code from scratch. And so we can save that verification. But I think the much more important thing is the fact that once you go into chiplets, you just short circuit the verification altogether, especially all the physical stuff, the running DRC on the deck, running signal integrity, power resolution. Once you have a die, you have a physical device that you can do a data sheet for. And then the verification goes down drastically. So the idea of turning IP into a hardened physical device is sort of raising the level of abstraction by a lot. Now we just have a box with pins on it, as opposed to a white box that you really have to verify every time you tape it out. And we see this a lot with, especially with complex IP like SerDes and memory controllers, where even though we license it from big vendors and we pay them millions of dollars, we still have to spend 6 to 9 months before we tape out. And imagine if instead of that, you had a memory controller chiplet that just worked, and all you had to do was hook up the pins properly and you're done. You can imagine how much you can save in that. So that's my spiel.
Thank you, Andreas.
So let me just quickly say to Andreas, right now at the OCP thing, Arm is presenting their chiplet interface. But right at this moment, it's on their screen because Ron just sent it to me in
I saw that. The more standards, the merrier, they say.
Yes, I learned from Sadash Shankar that we're in conflict with the OCP workshop today. Okay, I think that's all. Any last questions or comments from anyone? All right, if not, invitations open to all the Meerkat teams. Feel free to reach out to me or any of our leadership team here at Decode. We're happy to have follow-up discussions.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Everyone.
Thanks, everyone. And we will provide our slides. So,
thanks. Okay.